call the meeting to order. I'm Tom Rutledge.
I'm Natalie Stone.
John Behar.
I'm Hogan Karnofsky.
Ellie Hassenfeld.
Ari Herman.
Guys on the phone.
Hi, it's Wendy Miller.
Tim Ogden.
Good. And Greg Jensen is on his way. That may sound familiar. Okay. So we sent out, this is a pretty basic board meeting. We don't have any big decisions to make. We kind of took care of all the, you know, the official board business is the last one. So I think it's fine for this meeting to be very open-ended and kind of the spirit of the conference calls we've been doing. We sent out two attachments. One was our basic progress. One was our basic budget situation. I know I sent them, you know, at the last second, so it's. I mean, basically, if people haven't read them, that's okay, and we can just catch people up on our progress and on our situation. And the real broad thing I would say, you know, just to sum up, I guess, the whole situation right now, we've mostly stuck to the plan that we had earlier. I think that we are behind on research where we said we would be. We're not, like, super far behind, but we're going to get a little bit less done than we said. And we've done more work on kind of partnerships, and especially on these general charity frameworks that, you know, that wasn't really on our radar in February, but it's been more on our radar lately. We're, you know, obviously planning the trip to India, and my having gone to Africa, those are two of the reasons that we, you know, we haven't made and don't plan to make quite as much progress as we said on research. But, you know, broadly, things are pretty close to what we thought they would be, and financially, it continues to be the case that we're in reasonably solid shape at our current level of operating expenses, and we would need, you know, we would need to find new sources of funding if we wanted to expand a lot. Meeting adjourned.
Well, do you want to maybe talk about that last point?
Sure.
I guess kind of both sides of the balance sheet. One is what are any notions you guys might have about expanding a lot, and what are your notions about where, you know, what we would do if we had a lot more money and where it would come from?
You know, it's interesting. It's something that Paul and I talk about a decent amount. I mean, I think that we want to continue growing the, you know, the, let's say, the research analyst core. Like, we have Natalie. She's contributed a lot. Simon Newton's been working over the summer. He's contributed a lot. And to the extent that we can find more people like that, I think that we can cover more areas that we, you know, that are similar to the ones we're doing now, like microfinance, where we know a lot about them and we can have a set up a framework. But I don't feel like there's a great, you know, the place we struggled with in that is finding the people, finding really good people. I also don't think it's a huge benefit and, like, will make a huge difference to the ultimate success of GiveWell, whether we had, you know, two analysts or four analysts. And so, I mean, my general feeling is that a lot more money is not really a big bottleneck to GiveWell's ultimate success. A lot of what I feel has happened this year is, you know, just by dint of us having been around longer and continuing to gain credibility, we have more opportunities to speak with and deal with other organizations in the sector. You know, the GuideStar partnership is a good example of that. And I think that's the type of thing that's going to lead to more success down the line.
So what are the research areas that you think people besides you and Holden could cover?
I think the ones that come to mind are areas in international aid where people are very interested in, that we've just done a pretty cursory coverage of and said this doesn't really measure up to village reach. So the best example is water. You know, like so Natalie now is working on microfinance. We're trying to do something on disaster relief. That's not ready yet because for the analyst. But I think if we had an analyst, we might be able to get it to the point where they could do it.
Just to clarify, microfinance she is working on now. That is ready. Disaster relief is at the point where we're kind of still feeling our way along, but it may get to the point where it's ready.
You know, so then there's a cause like water, you know, where I think that we could have someone come and work on that the way Natalie's working on microfinance. And I don't know, I haven't thought that hard about all the different causes, but hospitals, you know, surgery organizations, you know, I think there's different sub-causes that people find interesting that we could do a deep dive on where they wouldn't the goal wouldn't be to find an organization that is the very top of the list, but if you really care about this cause, we can show you which organization is outstanding in that area.
Okay, and then the big things outside of that would be disaster relief as it currently stands, disease research, environmental causes. Is that kind of like a big...
I mean, broadly, there's the sort of existential risk causes, you know, global warming being one of them.
Yeah, I mean, I think catastrophic risk is the term I'd use. Just anything, like, might be really bad, whether or not, you know, and just trying to reduce a small chance of something really bad happening. I mean, there's no, like, you know, there's no conceptual limit to the causes we can do. We just try to, you know, we're trying to focus on the ones that we actually think are, like, high potential for, like, us, as, you know, that we would be interested in and that the people we serve would be interested in. So, I mean, because we are creating this sort of do-it-yourself guide, so we're going to soon be publishing that, and that's kind of, we've come up with, you know, critical questions you could ask about any charity at all, and any cause that we were able to think of or able to find. But I don't, you know... I don't know that it's that productive to try and pour a lot of research hours into every cause. I think there's a few that we're interested in and that our target audience is potentially interested in. That's pretty much it. But they are tough. I mean, I think it's worth noting, you know, disease research, for example. I mean, we've been working on that off and on. We haven't really devoted, you know, we've always been doing other things, so we haven't put anything like the kind of time into that we put into international aid a year ago. But, I mean, we've had some false starts, and we really, you know, we've kind of struggled to get a foothold and say, you know, this is definitely what we're looking for. And so it's just a real hard thing to predict, like, how we're going to make progress on that. You know, and I do think we will eventually. I think, like, you know, there are going to be ways to distinguish, but it's just there could be a lot of false starts.
So I'd be interested in, A, hearing more about the false starts, and, B, talking about how this idea of, you know, there are some things that we could do and some things we might not do or fits into the overall idea of how GiveWell succeeds if it's not in covering lots more causes.
Well, do you want to talk first, Ellie, about disease research?
Sure. So just a couple, you know, in case you want, you know, we sent updates to our Yahoo email list of what we've done and what paths we've gone down and what we've found and what we haven't found and where we are right now. The main false starts, I'd say, that we thought might be promising and don't appear promising to us now are, one, trying to identify diseases that have a particularly high burden relative to the amount of funding that goes into them. And that, you know, that you could see that as a pretty promising approach. If there's a disease that affects a lot of people and a lot of money isn't focused on it, you'd have some opportunity to make a difference with charitable dollars. The way in which that's one that we may pursue is distinguishing between developed world conditions and developing world conditions. But what we found is that the pharmaceutical industry plays such a large role in the funding of research, and the, you know, there's not a lot of, as far as we know, you can't get information on funding by disease from industry in a way that would really give you a picture of what the overall funding situation is like for each disease. So, you know, that is sort of a broad approach for narrowing the field hasn't been successful.
That charity may not be funding research in some diseases because the pharmaceuticals are spending way more money than anybody could come up with anyway, and that would therefore.
The question being, when you add
dollars.
Yeah, I mean the idea being, if you have, you know, well, broadly, you know, the pharmaceutical industry is about 45% of disease research funding. The government's about 45%, and charity is 10%, maybe even less. So it's already a very small piece of the pie, and so the question is, when you add additional dollars into that pie, what are you getting? Well, one thing you might want to look for is a disease that really doesn't have a lot of focus on it, but affects a lot of people, or at least affects a lot of people for the amount of focus. You know, that might be a way that charity could play a role that was effective, but we just haven't been able to find that in any way that is compelling.
Got it.
You're just missing a huge set of data on where the money goes, and without knowing where the money goes, it's hard to know where not enough money is going versus where too much money is going.
Got it.
Then another false start is we said, well, let's just set our goal to be, you know, finding one outstanding organization that can convince us that, you know, they're doing a great job, that we would get behind, you know, regardless of the disease. And so the group Faster Cures put together this philanthropy advisory service focused on disease research organizations. And they wrote extremely in-depth profiles of, you know, roughly 20 to 25 organizations across a few different diseases. They consulted with experts and scientists in the disease areas. And so we went through that report very carefully, saying, look, someone's already done a lot of the legwork on getting information out of charities, trying to match it up to the available scientific research and trying to figure out what is good or not. And having gone through that, we weren't able to gain confidence and really understand what each organization was doing and how it, you know, giving more to it would impact, what it would, you know, what likely effect it would have, is the best way I can put it. I think it's possible that, you know, disease research is, you know, it's difficult in a few ways. It's difficult not only because we're not looking for past evidence of success, but you know, because evaluating the effectiveness of a particular project requires a lot of technical knowledge. And so, you know, it's not easy for us to go dig into an individual organization and evaluate whether or not, you know, their publication and citation record is promising, or whether the drugs they've developed are really good or not, or whether the approaches they're taking are promising or not. And so the approach of just, you know, diving into organizations about which there was a lot of information didn't lead us to things as it had in other causes, where we could say, look, we can start to see distinctions between organizations in meaningful ways that would lead me to want to recommend one over the other.
Yep.
And so, you know, where we are now, and we shared this on our list, is basically just trying to have as many, first we decided to, just for the purposes of research, narrow our scope down to two different diseases that were covered by Faster Cures, because that's when we know more about. So MS, multiple sclerosis, as a developed world disease, malaria as a developing world disease, focus on those two and try to talk to scientists and researchers in those areas about, you know, what is going on in those areas now, what are the promising approaches, what are the types of things that we could expect or not expect in the future, and what role additional funding would have. And those, you know, those are conversations that we're trying to have as much as we can to help us, you know, figure out where to go next and see what we can find in those, you know, if we narrow the field down from sort of all of disease research to two specific diseases, we think we might come to something a little more promising. And then another approach we want to take is to try to answer something I think you were getting at earlier, Tim, which is, you know, if you give money to disease research, what type of research are you really funding? You know, are you funding the best researchers or the average researchers? Or if you, you know, throw more money in the pot, are you just funding the guy at the very bottom of the pool who, you know, the top researchers basically are going to get money no matter what, and by you throwing more money in the pool, it trickles down to the, you know, let's say the guy in the bottom. And just trying to have conversations with researchers about their funding needs and what would likely happen with additional funding, so we can get a sense for how the, you know, the field works. You know, like it's easy to conceptualize what happens when you give, you know, a relatively, you know, a bed net charity like Against Malaria Foundation more money, they can provide more bed nets. It's not as clear how that works in the disease research field, and it's something we're going to try to answer. So those are the two paths that we're just starting those two things I said now. The time we spent previously has been on the paths that haven't been as promising.
So have you looked at all at some of the underlying sort of basic biological research that could have applicability to multiple diseases?
You know, do you mean as – so you're saying as opposed to looking at specific diseases, look at basic biology?
So from personal experience, as a for instance, and not suggesting this particular issue as something that's worthy of mention, but there's several different research centers that are extensively working on cilia and ciliopathies, which there's some evidence that shows that they underlie a great deal of different diseases, and that really understanding them could provide major advances in treatment of lots and lots of diseases. So that's what I mean.
Yeah, that's not something that we've considered specifically yet. You know, the idea of trying to evaluate, I mean, the way in which we tried to narrow it is by disease as opposed to looking at basic biology. That some of the people, I mean, some of the things that when we've talked to people, they've said is the, you know, the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, you know, the U.S. government funding is primarily funding basic biology as opposed to disease-specific. I mean, they do have disease-specific funding mandates, I believe, and certainly a lot of their, you can break down their funding by which disease it's tagged as, but they're primarily funding basic biology, and there's some question about the track record of funding basic biology. As, you know, that, I mean, one of the guys we spoke to said that he, you know, he thinks basic biology is overfunded relative to focus directly on developing treatments, you know, the clinical research.
Okay.
So that's the reason we haven't, I mean, if I had to say, you know, that's one of the reasons in my mind we said, okay, well, this is his opinion, so let's, you know, let's focus on the disease-specific, though it's not something I feel like I've ruled out, and, you know, we'll see how this new path goes, and we may go back to the basic biology thing in the future.
The overall dollar spent on R&D, is it growing annually, and has the ratio between corporate and other funding sources been roughly the same, or?
I don't know about the ratio changing. I mean, the amount spent on research is
one.
I don't know, like, how, I mean, it's grown a lot in the last, like, 15 years.
For what it's worth, and not to go too off topic, but, like, we're invested in a pharmaceutical company, and, like, they just did a merger, and the first thing that they're going to do is cut the R&D budget, like, dramatically. Like, today it's 12% of sales, and the CEO is going to take it down to 5% of sales, and it'll be $50 million less. And, like, from an investment point of view, like, if you look at the pharma space, like, they've pissed away tons of money on R&D with no return. And to the extent you see more mergers of companies with no pipelines, like, they're going to cut R&D. I don't know what that means, how much that moves the needle at all for how we're thinking about things or if that matters, but it might.
What do you mean mergers of companies with no pipelines?
Like the Pfizer's of the world, if you look at the pharma space,
yeah,
there's a lot of big pharma companies that have drugs that go off patent 2012, 2013. They don't have a lot of drugs in the pipeline that are going to replace them, the blockbusters. So you see big, large companies moving together. Their revenues really aren't going to grow, so they're just taking out a lot of costs. One of the cost areas to look at is how you've been spending on R&D but getting no return. And the answer, for the most part, is, yeah, like, the investment is not returned enough in terms of new drugs. So you can go through all the pipelines and say, you should really be investing in this. Just the first thing about dollars.
It's interesting.
Yeah, it's mostly because the blockbusters aren't happening anymore.
There are things we've seen that say, look at our medical R&D is up a ton in the last 15 years, and the production of new drugs is flat to down, and not even down relative to the dollars, like down in level terms. Mm-hmm. And so the dollars per new drug created is terrible. And so to the extent that means that research is overfunded, that would be a very powerful thing for us to know. But we haven't found someone, or at least we haven't yet, that would be interesting if we could try to see it, of people saying, you know, research is, I mean, people say it, but make a compelling case that you could argue, you know, research is overfunded. This isn't a good place to be putting money because, I don't know, there's twice as much in there right now as we need.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it just kind of sounds to me like it's a private sector shift in how they're thinking about how worthwhile the research is, which is interesting.
Well, it's like who's doing the research, I think, more than how worthwhile it is. So it used to be that the pharma companies did a vast majority of the research, and as biotechs became much more competent at doing some of the front-end research, it shifted from the big Pfizers of the world to smaller labs, and that's where it sits today.
Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, I would say that in terms of disease research, you know, we're attacking it like we attack any cause where we have a few ideas that from the outside seem like they're going to be promising, and then you dig in a little bit and you start to see that they don't work, and now we're taking a step back and trying to, you know, now that we have a little more knowledge about what's not available, talk to more people about what, you know, they think and try to see if we can find paths to go down. You know, because I do believe that, you know, ultimately we should be able to help someone make the decision. You know, like, I want to support cancer research. I can give to the American Cancer Society or Susan G. Komen for the Cure. Like, we should be able to give them guidance about you know, maybe not specifics of each organization, but certainly things to look for and things that make a difference in making that decision. All right, so that was the disease research. What was the other question, or any other questions on disease research? Do you remember, what was the other thing?
Well, the other question wasn't about disease research. It was high level. So if everybody's done asking questions about disease research.
Yeah, I think so. So what was your other question, Tim? I don't remember.
The other question is, you know, one of the things that we've been talking about is, you know, what does success look like for GiveWell? And the way you guys are talking about a lack of priority of expanding the research, it says, so what is our key metric of what we need to do more of to be successful if it's not cover more causes?
Well, we're not talking about lowering the priority of expanding the research. I'm kind of articulating a point of diminishing returns to expanding the research, which I don't know exactly where it is, but I don't feel like we're there yet. But what I'm saying is, like, you know, at some point I do foresee a shift in GiveWell to more, like, focusing on trying to, A, just systemize what we do and, you know, and have it be carried out in kind of a more reliable, maintained way. Kind of the way that we're already moving, and, you know, and be, so really focusing on that, and also just really focusing on all the stuff that we put off, the packaging, and the making it compelling, and the making our contacts and outreach, and so what I'm saying is, like, I see that shift happening around the time that we do, like, you know, these few causes that are appealing to us and appealing to our audience, not waiting for us to cover every charitable cause in the world. That's what I meant, not that, like, you know, not that we have a low priority on expanding research now. Right now, that's our top priority.
Got it.
But, I mean, you know, to go on that for a second, I mean, this is definitely something Ellie and I have been talking about. I mean, I am definitely, I think we're all a little bit hazy on exactly what the most likely path to success looks like. I think there's two paths that kind of seem like the leading paths that we've thrown out there and that I still do think are the leading paths, but I don't know, we've been talking about it, so I may as well bring it up. I mean, you know, one path is the kind of, you know, at a certain point, or, you know, it's not necessarily like a point in time, but it's definitely, you know, as we hit diminishing returns on doing more research, we really start to focus on, okay, how do we sell this? How do we spread this? And then we really try to say we've got a great product. Let's think like marketers and try to market it, which is something that I'm, like, not comfortable doing right now because I don't like our product enough to be trying to market it like that. I think it's the best out there. I think that we've provided a service to certain donors, but I don't feel comfortable doing that kind of broad outreach with what we have right now. And that's something that's, like, certainly debatable. And, you know, and I'm not, so, I mean, that's like, but one path is that, you know, at some point we cover more causes, but at some point we really switch our efforts to marketing and outreach and packaging. And the question is, what point is that? And I think it's roughly where I articulated it, because that's kind of, I picked that because that's where I'd feel comfortable. But there's arguments that that isn't going to look much different from if we just went out and did it now, and there's arguments that that would not be as effective as, like, waiting until we covered every cause in the world. So that's one path. Let me say the other one, then we can get back to discussing. I mean, the other path is really just, like, staying around, which is, you know, just sounds really lame, but that's where the systemization comes in, where, like, if we can make GiveWell something where, you know, we have good enough methods and it's systemized enough that we can basically have, you know, be always training new college graduates to come in and do it for a few years, and, you know, we're able to sustain it at a high level of breadth and a high quality of research and a low level of cost, then there's just this idea that as long as you can stay the best at what we're doing and recognize it's the best, then you hope that the world is going to catch up at some point and, you know, that attitudes are going to change, or even if attitudes don't change broadly, that, you know, the lightning strikes at some point, that someone comes along with a lot of money and says, I really want to make this work, or, you know, there's some event, and, you know, I mean, it's hard to predict, because, for example, when there was a big disaster, I mean, I did not think that that was going to be a catalyst for a lot of people to be thinking much more in the GiveWell mindset than they do when they do their everyday giving. A lot of people who never used us before were coming to us, you know, I wouldn't have thought of that, and I'm not a marketer, I wouldn't think of these things, so, you know, and there's just the fact of, like, staying around, you build a reputation, you build a track record, you build relationships, at the point where Charity Navigator is ready to to work with people at the point where someone else, a future aggregator like them, is willing to work with people, then we're there. So those are two possible paths.
So just my two cents on this is that, you know, if you ask me what's going to have the largest impact on the likelihood that GiveWell is a success 10 years from now, my bet would be heavily weighted on just sticking around, that's going to have the largest impact. You know, that, I don't know, that makes up like 80 to 90% of what I think is going to make the difference. Because that's one thing. And so that's why when, you know, Tom, I think the question is really, to me, it gets me thinking a lot when you say, well, what would you do with a lot more money or additional resources? And I say, well, I don't really know what I would do with them, because to me, most of the gains are going to come from being around. That's what it certainly has felt like over the past few years, though. I mean, obviously, we've done a lot of work, too. I wonder, and that makes me worry that, you know, if the best thing we have is sticking around, in a sense, that, you know, well, so that's one piece of how I see it. And the other thing is I, in terms of which causes we should do before reaching out, you know, based on the interaction we've gotten from donors and the conversations we've had about our research, I don't find the argument very compelling, though I see, you know, where Holden's coming from. I just don't find it very compelling that doing these additional causes will make a very big difference in the types of conversations that we have with donors and the way in which we're able to, communicate what we're doing and why it's important to them. I think it's certainly possible. I think one of the main ways in which it might make a difference, and this is something, you know, Holden argues, is that, you know, when you point the media to a resource, how narrow the resource appears can make a difference to how it's portrayed, and we certainly appear to be a relatively narrow resource right now. But I don't think, when I think about the speeches we've given, the talks we've given, the donors we've talked to, if we were able to say, oh, we have done more research in about the American, you know, about disease research, and we could point to the equivalent of Village Reach there, you know, that would really make a big difference to people. And the challenge that, the real challenge may be communicating the, you know, the philosophy, more than having covering more causes.
Yeah, and just to give my two cents, although Ellie mostly gave it for me, like
no one else will be allowed to speak.
Right. Yeah, I don't want that. Someone else speaking, that is. But what was I talking about anyway? I do think our biggest challenge is getting people to think along our lines. That's absolutely true. And not trying to push, you know, our top charity, whatever it is. But I also think it's like, I don't know, I think it's really hard to push a message like that without a call to action, without an alternative. This is kind of like what Tim did with the, you know, everyone hated the administrative expense ratio for years, but I agree with Tim that the right time to come out and do a really concerted attempt to bash it is when you had a reasonable alternative. And, that's kind of, you know, if you're going to run out there with a huge message, which I think we could do, about how you should think more carefully about your charity, I want something to point people to that's really helpful, and I'm just not comfortable with where we are right now. I think we've got a ways to go before I'm comfortable with it.
How far off do you think that is in terms of time?
My estimate, like, what feels right to me, and it's just a prediction based on nothing, so take that for what it's worth, which is nothing, but I'm giving it to you anyway, so I want to keep talking, is, you know, I think after we cover these causes that we're talking about, disease research, disaster relief, the existential,
risk.
Yeah, the catastrophic risk. I think at that point, you know, we'll have covered A, the causes that are like most likely to appeal to our target audience. B, I think we'll have shown a real sort of diversity of causes that we can tackle, because right now it's very easy to pigeonhole us as the guys who look for stuff that already worked on a given number of people and track the outcomes on their lives, which is true. That is what we are right now. So I think, you know, I think, and that I'm, you know, looking at 1 to 2 years, and I think that's going to be, you know, during that time we're also going to refine other things about what we do. So that's kind of how I see it.
I'm kind of curious what people think about as sort of a tactical objective, raising money. For GiveWell to raise money. I mean, the there are clearly pros and cons. You know, the pros are it's money that can be used for research or marketing or any kind of operations of the organization. It's money that can be, if we don't have direct use for that, it's money that can be donated to causes that we like. And I think just as a symbol of credibility, having money around is something that is going to potentially positively affect people, and on the other side of the coin, not having a lot of money and not having a big budget may make some people think that we're not substantial.
Well, I don't think the size of our budget matters all that much, but I think this, like, having more money to give to charities that we recommend would be huge. I just don't know how to accomplish that.
In terms of prioritizing the focus, I think the time to do that would be after the research vetting. Like, it's worrisome to me that Holden says he's not all that sure how good the product is, but it's also reasonable. We just don't know. But then once you have that, you know, sort of the qualified people who are signing off, then you can do that fundraising with a lot more credibility.
Yeah, in some way, maybe you could speed up that 1 to 2 year time frame.
But that's the thing. I mean, but that's the thing that we don't really think. Like, we, you know, I don't think that hiring more people is going to speed up the timeline. And to me, the best illustration of that is disease research. I mean, it's not something that we can hand off to someone. It's something that we really need to struggle with and figure out. Now, we could hire someone who takes that on, but, you know, that is not something that I think is going to be easy and may not even be possible, and so we spend a lot of time on it. You know, in terms of raising money, I mean, first of all, I wouldn't want to raise money without having a good reason to do it. Like, raising money, you have to say what you want to use it for, and that's not something I see right now.
Well, you should anyway.
If the best reason to raise money is to give out grants, I mean, that was sort of an original conception of what we had, and everyone, I mean, certainly people at first did it because it was necessary to get off the ground, but the main feedback we got was, why would I give you guys money to give out to charities? I might as well just give to the charities that I already, you know, you've already researched. You know, I'm not excited about giving up the choice in my giving. And so I think it's sort of a tough sell. Like, to me, it's like the core of what we do is, you know, from that mission statement, you know, we're finding outstanding charities and helping donors decide where to give, and it's not...
I'm glad we have that.
I know. We do rely on that thing a lot. There's no question. We shouldn't even joke about it because we use it so much. Lindy was right. You know, but just, it's like this extra step that, you know, it's like an extra thing that we're making ourselves do that's not really necessary for our mission because we sort of think it's going to help us in this other way, you know, by demonstrating credibility, demonstrating ability, demonstrating something. You know, if I really felt like the biggest obstacle for us was getting information out of charities, and the best way to get that information was to raise money and offer it, then it might make sense. You know, I think getting information out of charities is an obstacle and getting in touch with them, but, you know, there might be better ways than raising money, like using some of our contacts to get us in touch, if that's what we need to do.
All right, Ellie, what was I right about?
Oh, the mission statement meeting. We rely on that mission statement more than you could ever imagine.
Oh, I'm so pleased to hear that.
We have to cut that.
A tactical question.
Yeah, we don't want to admit it.
I have a tactical question sort of related to some of this, but if it's too off-topic, I don't think it's that off-topic. You guys had talked about, like, the blog as a form of outreach, as one of your better ways of, you know, getting known, being vetted, what have you. Have you had any way to track whether that's been successful? I know you're saying you're blogging at least, you know, one good post every so often, or every whatever it says here, every week, every day, whatever. Is there a way to track whether that's been an effective way of achieving the goals that you had thought it would?
I mean, we know that the blog posts generate a lot of interest. They certainly drive a lot of traffic to our website. They're also the way in which the media has found us numerous times. You know, that the media is looking for a story, they see our post and they want to talk to us about it. I think that is we could try to better quantify, you know, people who signed up for the email list who originated on the blog or something like that.
I kind of feel like the blog is I don't know, I think it gets linked to a lot by, like, the philanthropy blogs. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think one of the things that's gone fairly well this year has been our standing in, like, the, you know, the philanthropy evaluation community. As far as the blog's impact on more general web traffic and donors, I'm less sure, although it does account for, you know, a decent chunk of our overall traffic.
Do you find more subscriptions to the blog? Or you, I mean, I guess if you go into like a Google homepage, Google Reader or something, you can see how many people subscribe to the feeds. Has that gone up?
I don't think so. I mean, we haven't really changed the way that we've dealt with the blog. It's been, you know, reasonably consistent for the, you know, 3.5 years we've been blogging, except for some, sometimes we blog even more during giving season, you know, when the media is more attentive, donors are more attentive, there's more going on.
Have you found more people linking to your blog? Like, that was one of the metrics that you were thinking might be the most useful.
I mean, we know traffic that originates at the blog, and so, you know, that was in our metrics report from last year. I think it's like a quarter of our traffic is coming through blog posts, and certainly on a...
Sorry, what I mean is actually, like, other bloggers referencing the blog?
The blog is certainly the thing that gets linked to much more than the website, because a lot of other, you know, people don't reference a static website that often. But
yeah.
They'll say, oh, look at this post on the GiveWell blog about Harlem Children's Zone, or look at this post about microfinance.
Okay.
We definitely get linked to. I don't really have a sense that we're like that we've seen growth in that.
Yeah, I think of that as sort of a cheap marketing thing, but you know, if you're unable to track its impact, then questionable.
We're not unable to track. We haven't put together a chart of like. It would be a little tricky to, like, you know, to talk about who linked to us and what was the quality of the link and put together a time series, but we could.
Yeah, I mean, I also think that one of the ways the blog has an impact is it allows people who want to follow us to follow us in a way, you know, they stay in touch with GiveWell and see what, you know, we're doing and what we're producing and interesting little thoughts. And I often see people commenting on the blog who, you know, donated a year ago. We haven't really heard from them. They get our email updates every few months, but... that they're, you know, they're clearly reading the blog. And so to me it's valuable because it allows people to stay up with us in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, another thing the blog does is we're just organizing our thoughts and, you know, trying to, a lot of the blog, I mean, ends up linked from the main site or we adapt it into the main site. So it's multi-purpose. I mean, we could make a time series analysis of, like, the traffic, and, you know, I think the traffic has roughly, I would guess it's grown like the rest of our traffic. The links, the prominent links, all I can say is we could do that. We haven't done that. It feels to me like, well, it does feel like we've been getting a little more attention lately, but, I mean, it's not something that's been exploding or anything. It's mostly like the people in philanthropy link to us on a somewhat regular basis.
Just FYI, too, on trending there, I don't know if this is common, but for me, RSS growth, you know, people subscribing, has the rate of growth has fallen dramatically, while the rate of following on Twitter has gone up dramatically.
Right. Yeah, I've heard some stuff about that, RSS versus Twitter.
In a lot of ways, you know, I just see the people who want to keep up with philanthropy action are not using RSS anymore.
So crazy.
That's interesting. I hadn't heard that.
See?
Kids today.
I don't know. That's how I feel.
So does that indicate that GiveWell should be using Twitter as well?
We do use Twitter.
Okay, I didn't even know that.
Yeah,
we primarily use Twitter to say we have a new blog post.
We occasionally retweet something that we like. We're not super active Twitter users, but we do use it. We do tweet every blog post.
Don't even know you use Twitter.
Yeah. No, we do. Follow us on Twitter.
That's how I know when they post a new blog.
Tim is the kid these days.
I know.
So Tom,
I really am.
Tim, doesn't it annoy you that there's no way on Twitter, let's say you miss a week, to go back through the week?
Like, miss a week? What?
Yeah, so there's this issue of Twitter being so real-time that if you're off it for any significant amount of time, it's really difficult to find out if you missed anything.
Yeah.
Unlike an RSS feed where you can just go back and look at the historical RSS feed quickly. There's so much coming,
so much of it is recursive, and there's no easy way to go back in time.
Yeah.
So
that's
if
why,
you miss,
yeah.
missed it. That's why I don't understand how people follow multiple hundreds or thousands of people, because you would never see anything, because it would just be moving past you so fast. But that's just me.
And that's why I am such an, apparently, such a non-kid that I have, I've converted Twitter to email just so that I can get around that problem.
I fooled you all by coloring my stubble gray. None of you have realized I'm actually 17.
So, Tom, sorry, did we get to answer your question?
Which question?
About donate, should we just raise money?
Oh, well, I mean, I heard a few opinions. Do you guys have other opinions? Tim and Lindy?
So I certainly agree that there are diminishing returns after probably 5 to 10 more causes, at which point the amount of effort to cover a new cause where there probably aren't all that many great charities anyway, and our last sort of headline things. So I can see us within the next 2 years saying more than half the effort is around raising money. But, you know, I think until we cover 10 to 15 of the most common causes, I don't think we get there.
And I don't think that raising money is nearly as important as raising awareness at this stage. But, I mean, I think that, you know, having more people on board, like if you could find, you know, if you could secure someone as another full-time person, I think that might be useful. It doesn't require a huge amount more money, particularly if, you know, you're going along Tim's line saying 5 or 10 more causes. I think that could be of great use to the organization, but I think that, you know, maybe it means hiring a marketing person or something to get the message out there and to do some of the education kind of side of things as opposed to just the promotion of GiveWell, which Holden and Ellie might argue are the same thing, but I'm not sure that it is.
No, I mean, I agree. We don't want to... And I think Tim means that. I mean, more than I do not picture more than half our time being spent on soliciting money for GiveWell. I picture it being spent on what I call packaging and outreach.
Right. So perhaps to hire people who have the skills that you guys don't have, or hiring people with skills or the potential to learn the skills that you do
right.
have.
Right.
That's great.
Going to come in just as it ends.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I just think it's a really interesting question to think about, whether we should be doing more research to improve the product so that we really feel we have something great that we, when, you know, like in Holden's words, that we can feel good about pointing people to it, versus saying the biggest challenge for GiveWell is going to be communicating the philosophy and convincing people of the message. And so the best thing we can do is attack the biggest challenge as soon as we can. And I'd say that I think, you know, if I lean towards attacking the biggest challenge, like to me that's, you know, Holden leans towards the improving the product and doing the research, and I think I lean towards attacking the biggest challenge, though I think I certainly see where he's coming from on his side.
Well, I mean, I think it's a little bit of a catch-22. We've been having this conversation for over a year, and well, maybe longer, and you know, to some extent I think if you do the education and outreach, you are able to bring people into the conversation and have dialogue that makes your research more salient and relevant. So, you know, just like you've gotten ideas of what are the top 10 things I need to ask when I'm donating to a charity, the do-it-yourself idea, or you know, I want to give to cancer, which one should I give to? You begin to get more of a dialogue happening when you bring people, quote, into the fold who don't already subscribe to The View and aren't just looking for where to, you know, aren't already bought into the idea and looking for a charity to donate to, but rather don't even know that this is something that they should be looking for or aren't educated about it. So I think it's probably not one or the other. It's something that happens in tandem and makes GiveWell more relevant for people and also makes people sort of more relevant for GiveWell, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, that's all true. I still feel like better research would do more for outreach than better outreach would do for research at this point.
Maybe. I guess it depends on who you think your core customer is and whether you think it's like a tree falling in the forest and no one hearing it. You can do all the research you want, but I guess it depends who we're trying to target. And, you know, I don't think it's one or the other at this point in GiveWell's evolution.
Well, it's never been one or the other. I mean, right now we mostly spend our time on research, and we take what we consider low-hanging fruit opportunities to get some attention or to get some partnerships, and at some point I think that'll flip.
Right, it's always been like that, though. I mean, the balance has always been to the research, which rightly so, but are we getting to a stage where maybe we're very close to not flipping, but at least bringing a little bit more of the other in? The only time it's flipping is if it's at the expense of, i.e. if we're resource constrained, so you and Ellie have to do the marketing or outreach, and I'm not sure that's the case anymore.
Well, I think we're resource constrained in that, you know, we could go out and try to hire someone, but I think that for an organization like ours, that would be an extraordinary challenge. And my guess would be that, you know, working ourselves on that, at least at first, would make more sense. But, you know, I could be wrong about that. The way in which, you know, it's a choice, and the way in which it is either or is that, you know, Holden and I do work on research. Holden works on disaster relief. I work on disease research. And the question is that, you know, is that the most important thing that's going to improve GiveWell's likelihood of success, or is it something else, or is it, you know, doing a better job communicating the way we think about charity and getting more people to try to think in the ways that we do, you know, not necessarily more causes and more recommended organizations. And I'll just say, I mean, I don't, when I propose this, I recognize it's sort of a relatively broad, vague thing I'm saying. I mean, I don't have a specific plan of, you know, this is the type of outreach I'd like to do or the type of communication that I think would be effective. I just look at the research we're doing and think about what the likely effect will be, and I'm just not very compelled by, you know, what effect that will have 2 years down the line. You know, we complete the causes we're talking about. Are we then in a position to succeed? And I guess I'd say I'm skeptical about that.
Should I try and catch up, Greg, on this real quick, or are you already caught up on what we're talking about?
Well, I think I understand the different points of view. I'm not sure what brought the topic up. It's up to you. You don't have to come back for me.
I mean, the question was, what's the path to success? And we basically feel like, you know, one thing that's true is that at a certain point we hit diminishing returns to research, and we want to focus more on outreach and packaging. And the question is, when is that? And that's the differing points of view. And then the other possible path to success is a little bit more like, you know, just being around, just building up a track record and contacts and a presence and being in a position for something good to happen when interest in this is higher for whatever reason is also valuable. And so that's, you know, those are the possible paths to success. And the just being around part, I mean, you know, we try to take what we're doing and as much as possible make it so it doesn't rely on, like, me and Ellie. And that's, like, a slow process. We've made a ton of progress on it, but we've made some. And we want to eventually be something where, you know, we kind of have an operation that can keep all this research up to date. It doesn't really need us. Or anyone in particular. Except Natalie.
I mean, I remember like a year ago when we were talking about the idea of trying to make a more aggressive marketing push. I think one of the points you guys made was you didn't want to have kind of, you know, just a press release mill running. You didn't want to have some kind of, you know, amateur effort to generate press and generate awareness. And I think you actually presented at one point sort of the alternative of having a kind of a senior person who was, you know, knowledgeable enough about the research to be able to articulate it to people, at least on sort of an introductory level. And to me, it just seems like I think we should keep open that idea for when the time to really make a marketing outreach packaging push comes, because it seems like having somebody who could who kind of own some of the relationships with the key donors or potential donors or key philanthropy world peers, and follow up on things and determine when is there just a message to communicate, when is there a fundraising opportunity, when is there a project to follow up on, and whose job is really to have those conversations as opposed to doing the research. I think there's some merit to that.
I think at this point we have few enough opportunities that we stay on top of them okay ourselves, although, I mean, it would be nice to, I mean, it does sometimes, you know, start to eat into our time, but we certainly, it's not like we, I don't know, I think we stay on top of most opportunities that are decently high quality.
But I think the point is to be able to generate new opportunities as well, or to expand what's currently been done.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, one of the things that just, you know, has changed, I think, in my thinking over the last year is both the things that we've done. You know, so for example, a year ago, the website was such a giant disaster that you couldn't point someone to it and have them even find out what we had done. Like, it was impossible. And now someone can get there and navigate it and figure out what's there. And so that to me, I mean, at least in hindsight, seems like a very necessary step to take before you start pointing someone there. And then also, you know, the more that we talk to donors and see how they react to the research and how there's, it just seems, and I understand that you'll probably argue with this, but it really seems like there's very much a couple types of people, the people that are thinking about charity the way we are, and then they engage to some degree in our research. And I'm just not very convinced that the expert causes is really going to find us a big group of people, you know, that we're not already reaching, or that it's the way in which we'll convince new people, right? Like finding the people that would think that way if we had those causes, or it'll change their minds. And so those, you know, it's learning more about donors and feeling like, I guess I feel better about where the product is right now and how comfortable I am pointing someone to it. So I, you know, recognize the weaknesses you state.
I think we had this conversation when we were in Boston, or the group of us who were there, and I pretty much disagree with that. Like, I actually think there's a huge market of people who might be very interested in this, but would never occur to them.
But do you think that the way to reach those people is by, let's say, adding a big cause like disease research? Or, you know, because I agree with you, there's a huge market of people that this would never occur to, and that are, to me, the big challenge we face is reaching those people and convincing them and sharing what we do and why we do it to them, to convince them to think differently.
Why do you think that? So first, like, why do we think that?
I think
there's a huge market of people that...
I think, well, I don't know about the size, so I can't speak to the huge. The thing that I've seen, like, I feel like, you know, Holden is the person who wanted to give to charity and started thinking about where should I give. And I was the person who needed someone to bring it to me and said, oh, my, you know, Holden brings this question, where should we give? Let's talk about it. And I'm like, hold, you know, this is such a bit, this makes so much sense to me. Before I was just, you know, saying, okay, Harlem Children's Zone sounds good to me, that's where I give. And when we talk to donors, I feel like there's the people that are uninterested in any way in what we're doing because they give to their charity. And then there's the people, and a lot of them were people here, who are like, oh, wow, I never really thought about it that way before. But now I see what you're saying. It makes sense to me. I want to support it.
And I mean, I'm talking anecdotally, but every single person that I talk to about GiveWell has that sort of reaction of, oh, that makes a lot of sense to think that way. You know, how could I learn more? Maybe it doesn't change their behavior, but I think about all of my younger, more junior colleagues at Deloitte who don't yet have, like, affiliated charities necessarily that take up all their donations. They're all interested in this kind of thing. And, you know, my parents, their friends, I mean, it's anecdotal, but I think there are wide groups of people. To answer your question, Ellie, I'm not sure that it's one or the other. I don't think it's tackling one more cause. I think it's tackling one more cause and spreading the word in a more sort of populist kind of way. I don't know the right answer, but I think it's a combination of those two things.
And one thing that I have trouble with this, because I feel like I just have such wildly fluctuating views on what the market is for what we do, because and like sometimes it feels like it's so easy to sell this idea to someone, and sometimes it feels like it's so hard. And, like, one of the things that throws me off might have to do with the fact that it really feels like people who really have money and give away money are, like, less likely to be interested. And this could just be a generation thing. Like, it could be, you know, or not even, by generation thing, I don't mean age. I mean, like, are you committed already? Do you have, you know, charities that you support already? But I kind of feel like, you know, I talk to a ton of people who are like, boy, that makes a lot of sense, but they don't give anything, right? And so there's not really much to do with them and much to follow up. And then we run into so many people who are like, well, anyone who actually gives, they're like, this is where I give, you know, screw you. And there's some people who are neither of those. There's some people who do give a lot of money and give it through us, but not many of those.
Right, and I think that the thing is that it doesn't surprise me at all, like, intellectually, that people say that's cool and that that's different than what you actually need, I think, which is that people change their actions. I think those are hugely different things, because people give for lots of reasons, and actually, like, I think if you look at when people are donating to charity, like, I would guess this, that if you took a brain scan of what they were doing, it's much closer to what they're doing when they're, like, kissing a girl than when they're, like, selecting a stock or something. Like, I think that this is a pretty different part of their brain, and they're doing, the motivations are just so different that it, both things make sense to me, that the intellectual part of their brain, then you could have the conversation, so this is, oh, that's cool, and it doesn't change anything.
No,
and so that's why the signals are confusing, I would think. So I don't know how you break through that or whatever, but that seems like a very, very tough challenge to make, force people into making the connection, which I don't. So that's what
I mean.
I don't
one
know
thing, one thing I've thought about, which is such a like daunting idea that I have no idea how to pull it off, but would be, you know, it's like people are much more receptive to our message when they kind of haven't thought about it yet, when they kind of haven't, you know, haven't settled their giving habits. And so if you could somehow like get those people to take a pledge, to be on a list, to sign up, to do something, to make some kind of commitment. Okay, this is how I'm going to give. And then, you know, later they have money to give and you come back and remind them. I mean, that might be effective. The problem is that you don't know who you're going after when you're doing that, because anyone you talk to, you know, the whole point is that they're not giving anything now. So you don't know what they're going to be, and you don't know how many people you have to get that way, and it's just a hard thing to do.
Right. That's what I think, though. Like, I kind of agree with Holden in my view of it, in essence, and watching the people that you do affect at Bridgewater or whatever. Like, it's Bridgewater's, like, perfect ground for it. And you still, and you know, whatever the effectiveness there is, I doubt you could find a better market. And you still, and for others, it's like retraining their brain is what you have to do to when they think about charity, like think about it differently. It's almost, it's like a rewiring exercise.
But there are also things that we could just test. I mean, just brainstorming it, like, okay, you know, creating a Facebook like group or something where you say, give a dollar to the most effective charity, you don't know which one it is, or something, because I think this does appeal to people who give smaller amounts at a time, maybe, en masse. And it's just an example, but it's a way of, like, a campaign that enables us to do a little bit of cheap research as to does this catch on to different kinds of groups.
Yeah. I mean, we should test things when we have ideas. It seems to me, like, I agree the challenge is there. Like, it's very hard. I don't think it's easy. The question is, what does Giveable want to be, and what do we need to do to achieve that? Is it covering more causes? Is that what's going to make us successful? Is that the core? Is that the thing we should do in doing new research and new types of research? Or should we say, no, we have to, the thing that's going to help us is the rewiring exercise, so we should attack that, because if we can't do that, we can't succeed.
We just we talked about this again last year, but like the question of who is the target customer sort of dictates what the answer to that question is in some way, and we don't know who that necessarily is, right?
Right. If it's
there are different customer segments potentially.
Cause mostly, I think. I mean, it depends what they're donating to, I guess. Hey, I'm certainly interested in doing some of the new causes. It's just. I'm interested in you doing the other thing. If, like, there was actually a reasonable plan that I could see how it would work, then I'd be more interested. But the problem we have is we're in that phase of we don't know what the plan is.
Mm.
So what are you going to spend time on? And there's some chance that you're, what you know, one thing you know will be effective is going and researching those causes. Effective from the...
In terms of producing something,
something of value. The wild goose chase element of the other thing is... So I'm not saying which one I would choose, because I think there could be a tremendous gold mine in the wild goose chase, so it might be worth it, but that's...
Right, and that's why I'm not pushing the... That's why I don't sit here saying, let's do the wild goose chase, but I do think about what do I want Giveable to accomplish in 5 years, and I'm just skeptical. Like, the research value in and of itself is one thing. I agree that there, but I wonder if it, I'm skeptical that it has that additional impact on the, like, I don't know, getting more people to give more effectively as, the, you know, the mission. And so then I wonder, you know, to the degree that that is not going to work, is that the thing I want to pursue? Or is that the thing I think we should pursue?
So are you guys, so I also, by far the most uninformed, also cut me off at any time, but so are we tracking, is the progress on people getting informed about Bridgewater? Jeez, plenty of people know about Bridgewater.
we're working very hard.
Yeah. Is the progress on getting GiveWell, like how are the website hits and whatever, all the metrics, do we get to those metrics? And
yeah, we did them in February, and we keep them updated so we could, you know, show the, share the charts. The, you know, the basic story is that, you know, last year we ramped things up for giving season, and the website hits went way up. We went from like 10,000 people a month, or like 7,000 people a month coming up to 30,000 during the giving season, you know, 30,000 individuals. And then that came back down and leveled off around 15,000. And now it's a little bit lower because we changed over the domain from .net to .org, and that meant it's like...
It's, I mean, it's a lot.
Things.
It's like 10,000 now, right?
And now it's down to 10,000.
And that's because we changed our domain. I mean, we're almost sure, like, when we look at the charts.
So we see that, and then the donations going through the website are roughly twice what they were last year at the same time, which is pretty good because, I mean, the Peter Singer book has been around a whole year longer, but, you know, during April, March, April, May of last year, he was, like, on the radio talking about his book and about GiveWell, and he's not doing that as much now. So that's grown. And so, there, you know, there's that.
And that's, like, $6,000 a month, something like that?
Like, yeah, $7,000 a month.
So it seems like for those people, like, so then they're, that's, so are you disappointed by that progress? Like, I'm just trying to understand in terms of strategy.
No, I'm not disappointed by that progress, but I'm not, you know, I'm skeptical of the, you know, doing more research leading to more of that, you know, being the cause of growth. Like, if I had to say, like, let's just say we take...
It improves the experience of the person that's there. That's already going there. Right? They are looking to get updated, right? They're going to stop coming if there's not new stuff. So let's say, I don't know, 10,000, how many people you think it is? Like,
well, it could, it, look, it could just be, I mean, you know, the work we've already done is the most, you know, the most compatible with what Peter Singer's out there doing. I mean, it could just be that Peter Singer goes out there and says, give. People come to GiveWell this year, top charity they give, and that happens more in December. So, I mean, there's certainly an argument that doing more causes doesn't do much for a current audience. There's definitely that argument. And we did a survey, right? We did a survey where we asked people, like, what causes you like and stuff. And, like, you know, it's overwhelmingly. Our current audience, they're into international aid. They don't want us to cover other things. I mean, they didn't ask us not to. But they're, you know, that's what they like. And
about that, but that's because you did the research. I'm saying if you somebody that studied disease research wrote a book and found you guys, and then they would talk about
it. I think the most compelling argument for the research and one Holden makes is that, you know, we do the research and that leads to the people finding it and writing about it, whether it's the media or it's the guy that wants to write the disease research book. And I think, you know, it's possible that that's the, you know, that's the best path we can take. The thing that is, you know, I struggle with is if I say, what is the, if I wanted to allocate the things that will have the most impact on success in 5 years, it would be like 80% just sticking around and being there and, you know, gaining that credibility from being around longer and longer and more people finding us. And, like, that remaining 20% is broken up between direct outreach and more research. And so, you know, that's how I would put it. Maybe, you know, then the only thing we can control is the research, and that's the thing with the best plan, so that's the thing we have to do.
But the being there is because you're doing the research. Like, yeah, I don't know, it's not, like, a fresh and, like it seems like...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, keeping it, you know, being there in a way that is... It's not necessary to do more and more and more breadth, but just keeping the stuff up to date and being alive, the blog happening, you know, so it's really new, you know, doing more narrower causes.
You could definitely picture, like I said, I mean, you could picture being there without doing any more causes. You know what I mean? Just continuing to write about the causes we've done.
So, it would be like the opposite of the expand. It would be the contract, you know, and like the contracting get well where you don't need four people to do ever-expanding research. You could have two people just keeping it going and doing a few things.
Well, why would you grow just by... That seems less compelling to me. Like, you figure it'd be the same audience, and you're just keeping them happy, but...
Well, you grow because, I mean, more... like, first, you have the partnerships with these other organizations. Like, there were 2 years ago, GuideStar wouldn't have wanted to talk to us, and now we're GiveWell. You know, we do something, we're known, and that grows over time, and I think just the people finding us has, you know, grows over time, more people are finding us and coming to the website.
Yeah, I mean, just to be clear, I don't like that at all. I mean, what I care about even more than covering other causes is just getting more versatile and more deep in our research. So, like, we have this very specific methodology now that's very contingent on, like, finding things that you could trace all the way to the improved lives that they've worked before, and we're, like, slowly branching out from that to be able to, like, say interesting things that don't rely on exactly that sort of analysis. And I think, like, even just for international aid, I mean, the fact that our report currently just doesn't recommend any water charities and just says, look, we don't have a strong enough connection between water and, like, the end goal to recommend it, I think is, like, totally understandable from where we were coming from when we didn't know anything and we were donors, and it's true, there's not a lot of hard evidence connecting water to later life outcomes. But at the same time, like, as we continue to exist, I want to cover water because there's a lot of people who are convinced that in a lot of areas what's really needed is water. And you don't have a formal study of that, and that's okay. Like, that, like, I'm convinced of that in certain areas. You know, it's being able to, like, to have a more versatile research process that kind of, hey, if you have this assumption, if you have that assumption, then we have something for you. I think that is necessary. Like, without that, our track record is only going to be bad for us. Our level of respect among people we care about is going to go down. Because there's international, for example, there's international aid scholars now who basically see where we're coming from, they see where we're started out, they understand our limitations. If 5 years from now we're still saying don't give to water, I think they're going to get out of here. And if 5 years from now we've got a deeper and more multidimensional understanding of international aid where we have a recommendation contingent on different worldview assumptions you might have, I think they're going to respect us more. So to me, staying around involves doing more causes in some sense.
I totally agree. I think you need to validate the broader research model, right? Disease research, you know, we know it's a cause that a lot of people care about. We have no idea if that's even in the sphere of competence, right? It just might not be. Until you actually do it, get something, have it vetted by people who know what they're talking about, and then, like, why would you be reaching out to people to try and get them to look at a product that you don't even know if it's any good?
But, I mean, we know, we do think, anyway, that our research is better than what else is out there. I just think that if all we did...
A different type of research.
Yeah.
I think that's a lot less certain for this new type of...
Oh, yeah.
New types
totally.
Of areas.
Totally. But, I mean, the question is whether we should even do new areas. So I'm giving, you know, one answer is you do more areas, you have more of a potential audience. I'm also saying, like, in some senses, doing more areas, like, fleshes out your model, makes you more credible, makes you less one-dimensional, earns you more respect, and if you don't do it, you're going to lose respect over time because you're just going to be saying the same thing and people will expect you to move on.
So it's kind of like, in your model, you do this for another couple of years, you're growing out, and then you flip more from research to outreach.
That's roughly what I'm thinking,
so,
yeah.
Just to understand Ellie's point of view, it doesn't sound like you're convinced that the outreach will work, or I wasn't exactly sure what you meant.
I thought Ellie's perspective is that it's no better to do that later than now.
That would be my question. Or do you just think you should never really take too much resources onto outreach if you're not going to work?
I mean, broadly, that it's no better to, you might as well do it now. But, like, there's a big, I don't know, I see a big challenge in the outreach, and so I'm kind of, I'm inclined to try to tackle that really big challenge first.
I mean, I think a lot of where Ellie's coming from is, like, you know, we could do the outreach now, we could do the outreach late. Okay, so everyone agrees that at some, you know, both are going to happen. Like, at some point it's appropriate to do research, at some point it's appropriate to put the emphasis more on outreach. When is the right point? And where we disagree, I think Ellie's a lot coming from the place that, like, the sooner we do the outreach, the sooner we kind of tackle the big challenge and we know more about how viable our project is, period, and whether it should continue, period. And where I am, I mean, I'll just admit, like, my position is, like, largely emotional, but it's a kind of emotion that I think is meaningful because it's, like, indicative of what our target market. Yeah, it's a rational emotion. Like, it's indicative of what I think our target market is going to think like, which is that I am not ready to sell this thing that actively because I just don't feel good enough about it. And, like, my analogy would be that Ellie's tired of that, you know, if you're trying to make a cookie business and, like, you're not happy with the taste of the cookies yet. And I know you could say to me, well, you'll never be happy, but I think I will be. I'm happy with our international aid report now for what it is within its boundaries. And, you know, I don't want to be, like, putting all that effort into hawking cookies that I don't, like, feel totally good about and feel are applicable to the people I'm hawking to.
I only get a couple of good cookies you want with flavors.
Yeah, that's true. But it's, like, it's broadly, like, am I happy with the product that I'm trying to sell? Like, I am within certain parameters. Like, I think it's the best thing out there now for certain kinds of people. But I'm not comfortable, like, doing a big thing where I'm trying to, like, create a big message about how you should think harder about charity and really sell it to the media and everything like that, and when people read it, where they have to come is our site, where we basically say, we looked for charities that could prove they were saving lives. I mean, I just, I'm not comfortable with that.
Is what you're distinguishing between whether marketing is going to be more, it's going to have a higher payoff later than now, or is it an issue of, like, hurting the GiveWell brand? Like, marketing now, would that diminish later returns because people would come and see it's no good, and not no good, but that you're not happy with it. It's not the best it can be.
People would see that I'm not.
And they won't come. They won't come back later because they'll remember.
I think that's an issue. I mean, I think if we go out and market it now, I think it's going to go better later. Like, I think that, you know, the right point to do it is the point at which I have something I really want to hawk. So I think it's going to go better later, and I think it's, if we do it now, it could do some damage long term. But also, you know, if it's not the best time to do it, then it's also just kind of a bad use of our time.
And given that there is, that things are progressing, like even without, with the, just the way it's going, like the opportunistic and gradual thing is producing enough of an outcome to make it worthwhile to continue. It's not, that's the question I was asking in terms of proving it. Like, I'm trying to understand, Ellie, if there's an element of what you're saying is you're really still focused on whether to go forward, like a year or 2 years, or what is it that's in your head related to the need to do it now?
I mean, it's just, I think some of the question, you know, some of the question is what is the best path to take for GiveWell within the context of GiveWell? Like, what's the most likely thing to do that will lead to success? And then another question is, well, what are the success? Like, we've been doing this for a few years. Let's reflect on how likely it is that we're going to succeed and not just ask the question of what's the best path, but how good is the best path?
Yeah, I mean, you asked earlier if we're happy with the progress. Like, I have to say, like, I'm not. I mean, I don't know what the right benchmark is, and I don't know what to expect. So I'm not going to say I'm unhappy, and I acknowledge there's been progress. So I don't, you know what I'm saying, but I, just in terms of, like, how it feels, like, emotionally, I mean, we're 3 years old, and when you compare us to three-year-old internet startups, it's pretty weak. You know, a good internet startup after 3 years has grown a hell of a lot faster than us, and I know in many ways that's a ridiculous benchmark, but it definitely bothers me. And so I'm not, you know, the direction is certainly right, but there's a good argument that it's not nearly fast enough, and that's worth considering. I don't think I can describe what fast enough is for GiveWell, because I don't have any idea, because I know it's not appropriate to benchmark us to an internet startup, but I know what internet, I don't know what internet startups do. I know that they're much bigger than us. They're much faster than us in growth. Ellie would know more than I do about the actual numbers. Certainly, if you were to benchmark, we would know it too. I know you would.
I guess you know very, very little.
What numbers?
But just, like, what's typical for, like, a decently successful startup 3 years out?
Yeah, what
I mean,
traction. Let's just say, like, track users as just a benchmark. I mean, I don't know.
Unique visitors.
It's different. Everything's different.
Right.
It's
I told you. It's not the right benchmark. Yeah.
I mean, I don't think there's a certain type of internet startup that would have that sort of growth that you're describing. But a niche, like, it's not, like, you're not, like, YouTube. You're not, like, entertaining...
Right.
Everybody.
Well, and we're also not, I mean, it's a very important thing. Like,
but if you take the growth, just so I can understand it, like, if you compound out the growth that you've had, I mean, it's unbelievable, so it's not going to grow that quickly either, I would think.
Right.
So
it, no.
So, like, I can't imagine it working anything like something like that.
Right, like, it was a bad example, though.
Well, it's in my head, so, I mean, I'm, you know, when you ask if I'm happy,
right,
probably,
so
I don't know what else to
be
working to.
What are you happy with, right?
Right.
Would you be happy with it?
Well, another thing I'd be happy with is $10 million a year money moved, if I thought we were, you know, going to get there fairly
right.
soon.
Well, that's measurable, okay.
Yeah.
So then
yeah. But, I mean, mean, you know, so that's another way in which I'm not happy, that we had $1 million last year, but, you know, a little more than half of that is, like, something that I really expect to repeat this year. And so we may get back to $1 million this year if we're, like, lucky with the growth plus, you know, because there was some one-off stuff last year.
Mm-hmm.
So we may get back to $1 million this year if we're lucky. And I think it's very possible that 5 years out we're at, like, $4 million, and, you know, I want to be at $10 million. So, yeah, I mean, I'm a little, I'm not sure. And even 10, so that's another thing that's been bugging me lately, is that even $10 million, depending on how many charities it's divided up amongst, I mean, for us to really affect the way charities want to do business, I don't know what the right number is actually at all. I know that what Robin Hood does is enough, but I know that we're, like, we'll probably never be that, so.
Well, when you're thinking about your impact, I think you also need to remember the thing that's not capturing the money mood, right? Like, the fact that you are getting the partnerships, the GuideStar and Charity Navigator, and really are helping spread the message. Like, that's still part of the impact that you need to make.
Yeah, and it's part of it, and it's something we're working on. So, the biggest thing, one of the biggest things that's worrying me right now, I guess, is just that, like, there's a very small market for this kind of thinking about charity, and that unless you do something really creative, you know, and you can figure out how to rewire, like Greg says, you know, there's just a little money there that you're never going to create new incentives for charities, which is the thing I most want to do, you know, you can get all the partnerships you want. It doesn't matter. If people don't want it, they don't want it, you know? I mean, I'm not...
Really, the GuideStar partnership is a good example of something that, you know, a couple years ago, that's a big success, and I think it's a big success in terms of people accepting our research. But the, you know, the traffic we get from that and the reach that I think GuideStar has to donors through that is pretty low, like very, very low relative to what you would have thought.
Yeah, and that's a little weird because GuideStar is kind of a non-profit-facing group we kind of wish they were donor-facing, and I think oftentimes people talk about them as if they were donor-facing. But I think, you know, Charity Navigator, that's one of the things we've talked about really wanting to get. We really want a partnership with them. But, I mean, really, I mean, what would happen if Charity Navigator did exactly with us what they did with GuideStar? I think it's very possible that very little would happen. People go to Charity Navigator because their friend asked them to give to Heifer. They want to know if Heifer is a scam. They go to Charity Navigator. It's 4 stars. It's not a scam. They give. We don't fit into that. So Charity Navigator has a lot of traffic. So what?
I think we're going to come back to money. Maybe not tonight.
It always does.
I mean, I just think, you know, whether it's money moved or whether it's, you know, obviously it's in the back of a holding of mine.
That's always, I mean, that's the ultimate metric. So.
Yeah.
So you could give it that. So what would be, so our foundation's not, you can't, you don't think you can get that kind of thing again, or it's just not worth trying?
Yeah, what kind of thing?
It would seem like, if that's what you're targeting, money moves, that the path would be to go to them, people who are responsible for giving a lot of money, foundations of some type, and you wouldn't have to turn too many to get pretty big numbers, and I don't know what the effort is there, but I could imagine there being foundations.
Yeah.
Like what? Turn on Hewlett or whatever that
Well, we didn't turn Hewlett. I mean, Hewlett's like the one group that, you know, they're really interested in this.
They're like funding the mission. There was the other group that was
the other group, I mean, you know, that was good. But no, I mean, we're not getting that again, though, because they gave that for a very specific purpose. They didn't say, the problem with foundations is that they, you know, they are not excited to say, here's money, do the best thing possible with it. So that was a specific project. That was, like, the reason they gave us $250,000 is so that we could generate information about a specific cause. And then we used it, we generated the information, and that's what they wanted. They don't want to just keep giving, you know, $250,000 to our favorite charity in that cause. And foundations, you know, there's a whole bunch of hurdles. So they want to create things, they want to experiment, they want to, you know, do something, create something that they get credit for. It's not, like, find the best charity and give them an unrestricted check. I think that's a lot of how foundations work. I mean, hey, all that said, it's true. I mean, we wouldn't have to turn too many. So this is something we've talked about in the past. It's something we've tried in the past. It's something we've tried in the future. I think it's, you know, this is another value of GiveWell that, I mean, this is why Ellie and I are so big on the staying around path to success, as lame as it sounds, is because, like, you stay around, you get a big reputation, you keep getting better at your research, you're always the best, and it gets better and better. And then, you know, at some point, you have enough credibility that it becomes a much more reasonable proposition to turn some major foundation, or not to turn them, but they come to you. Somebody, you know, some very rich person decides they want to give away their money, and you've got a reputation, and he comes to you. You know, so there's all kinds of things that can happen just by staying around, doing the best research, and building a reputation.
Yeah. I think it may be worth thinking about, well, you guys know the foundation, so I mean, the call list is probably obvious to you, but it's probably something worth thinking about. Who would those calls be? And then almost put together a whale sales call. You know, what if I have a half hour with somebody who writes big checks, and I want to introduce them, you know, starting at square one with to GiveWell, you know, who we are, what we've done, what our accomplishments are, what our approach is, what our offer is to you, and what we would do with a big check. You know, see how that would go. I mean, that actually might help kind of craft a marketing approach generally. Just think about what would that meeting be like, and how would you want that meeting to run, and how would you follow it up?
Right, so it just sounds, I mean, one alternative path to the research path is the going after big checks path, which we, you know, that was a path we took 2 years ago. It didn't work then. I mean, obviously things are extremely different now, and so there's some argument that we should take that path.
And I would be against
that. I mean, the big downside of that path is it's not exactly the, like, the wild goose chase thing, but, you know, you do it, and you feel like you spend 6 months, and, you know, I guess you learned something, but you certainly haven't done more research, and 6 months, even though we're so old at 3 years, you know, it's a big percentage of our...
Yeah, you get behind it where you're supposed to be good at, and I wouldn't bet on it. I mean, I think basically, you know, a couple of years ago when we called foundations, they were like, who the hell are you? And that ended the conversation. If we called them today, I think they'd be like, oh, I read about you once on Sean Sanders Stockton's blog, and I don't think that's enough. And maybe if we called them in 5 years, it'd be like, oh, you guys are those hard-ass charity guys. So.
I need to step away for a few minutes.
Okay, thanks, Tim.
Just to warn people.
I mean, if each did one call a month, or it's,
just seems like we should decide if we think it's a good path and then, you know, do it as directly as possible, then, you know, as opposed to just being,
yeah,
like,
I don't,
let's
I don't
try to kind of flip it in without spending time on it.
I know early in the betting strategy was,
if you really want to get to $10 million, it seems to me that's the path, because it's like, I mean, one foundation could turn it, but if, maybe, I don't think there's another, like, doing that through the groundswell type of thing. So, I don't know. If it's the goal, I think you have to do it. If it's 4 or 5 years from now, then I don't think you need to do it now. Anyway, so the whole conversation started with the $10 million thing lingering in your head.
Yeah, I'm just saying that I'm, you know...
I mean, I guess that's the objective. The money moves is the objective benchmark that is a little disappointing. Where we can't go to charities and say, this is the money that we can offer you if you play ball with us. We still don't matter. Like, the best we can say is last year we moved $1 million, which is better than what we could say the year before. But we don't really have that money to offer. We don't have a lot of sway.
And I've run into that with a bunch of the microfinance organizations that are always asking, well, can you tell me a little bit more about what you can do for us? And then I ask them, well, how much money could you use in the next year? And they say, a whole lot more than you can get us.
Yeah, that's a big thing. So,
how much traction are you guys getting in terms of the votes of confidence from really highly credentialed people? I know you had a few quotes here, so like that. That's like, to me, that's the path to the foundations. The foundations are the path to the big money. But you're not even getting the door.
I think we're doing okay on that. I think we're, you know, in the kind of nonprofit evaluation subsector people, you know, who hang out with Hewlett Foundation, I think we've got a great reputation with them. And so we've collected some quotes from them. You can see them. We've got more on the way. And, you know, they really, you know, they all think of us that way. It's a matter of proving it and getting it on the record, and we're starting to do that. But, you know, I think we've got exactly the image we want with those guys, which is, you know, they think of us as the guys who are, like, real hard asses, do the most in-depth research, don't do enough causes, don't cover enough charities, but what we do well. That's that group. Then, like, you know, with other, I mean, I've tried to split the people we want endorsements from into different categories. So with the general, like, public intellectuals, I think, like, I feel fairly good. I mean, we have, you know, Peter Singer is a huge fan. There's, like, a couple other random people, like, that guy Jeff Miller is, you know, somewhat talked about in these kind of intellectual circles, and he, you know, wrote a positive essay and had us in it, and, you know, so, and I also, like, when I randomly get to meet those people, I mean, things usually go well, so it's, like, the kind of just, you know, oh, that's interesting goes well. I mean, Margin Revolution, which is kind of the leading, like, nerdy economics blog, they donated an ad to us last year, so it's, like, you know, we're on a decent path there. And then with the real, like, you know, another thing that I've wanted endorsements from is, like, real academics, people who are, like, you know, academics in the field of international aid. And those people, you know, I think that it's just really, like, that's a thing where, like, the people who are big names are just too busy to engage us, generally. There is, you know, there's one guy who we have kind of a relationship with who is, you know, pretty highly ranked and does like us. But I'm not sure I'm going to be able to get him on the record because he's very cautious about saying stuff like that. So I don't know. So, I mean, I think it's going okay. It's certainly not going badly. I mean, that's probably, if the money moved is the most disappointing thing, I think the least disappointing thing is, like, that, you know, we've got mostly the reputation we want. We've got, you know, and mostly when we do engage people, they react pretty well, and we're not, it doesn't seem like we're stuck on that. It could be a long road to actually get people to spend the time to talk to us and engage us, but, and it could even be endless in some ways, because, you know, a lot of those academics, it's like, they might be friendly, they might say you guys sound cool, but they're not going to, like, endorse you until they've really vetted your work. They're not going to vet your work, they don't have time. We did come up with one idea to try and make that happen, and we're going to try it out, but. But that's something, I could see us making progress on that slowly. I mean, we've got lower-level academics now who we're, like, engaging to really vet our research and really spend time on it. So they can talk to people, you know, we can get somewhere.
Yeah, and that's just the area I'd be pushing as hard as possible, because it shouldn't take that much time commitment from you. It's mostly just making sure the ball is rolling. It's got to be a must-have to really get in the door with other people.
We're pushing it. I mean, we're not pushing it. We're pushing it cautiously. You know, we start with people we feel really comfortable with, and then we see how things go with them. And, you know, and some of this, it's like, there's people who already know us, who all we do is ask them for a quote. So at this point, we've done that. But then there's people who it's like, if we could get them to engage, and that's where things get tough. But we're working on that. I mean, we're right now, we're just at the beginning phases. We've done our internal review of our research, and now we're asking people to do an external review where they spend a certain number of hours doing a certain assignment where they review what we do. So that's a start. Once we have that from some people, you know, and it's established and we've got a process that works, maybe we can try and get it from other people, and we can try and get their contacts. So I think we're moving on at a reasonable pace.
Hey, Bob.
Make sure it's still running.
So where would you like to take the discussion?
Outdoors. Can I change the subject?
Yeah.
You guys want to, anybody want to make any concluding remarks or anything? Could we just talk a little bit more about GuideStar and Charity Navigator and other similar relationships? I mean, you guys have come up several times. You said a lot of things, but could you give us kind of the coherent overview?
Yeah, I mean, the real quick overview is, you know, GuideStar's out. It's not a lot changing there.
we did create, I mean, there's these two general frameworks we've created that are really trying to make partners happy, because, I mean, partners aren't thrilled with us because we only recommend this small number of charities, so what do you do with that? We've covered this small number of causes, and even, you know, even in 2 years from now, that'll be true from their perspective for sure. I mean, they've got, you know, they've got, like, really 50 causes on their website. Maybe we'll have covered 10 instead of 2, but, or 5 instead of 2. So, you know, what we are trying to do for them is we're creating these frameworks that we think they can use as, like, general transparency tests of charities, and we think that would be, like, good for them and good for us, and it's, you know, just something worth doing. So, you know, we've got two different frameworks. We've got a general charity evaluation framework, which is just 10 questions for any charity, and they're questions along the lines of what do you do and does it work. You know, they're a little more detailed than that, but not much. And then we've got our... So that's 10 questions, and we've basically said to Charity Navigator, to GuideStar, to a couple other groups, like, it would be good to publish these and say charities get some sort of seal of transparency just for answering them. Doesn't matter what their answers are. And if we could do that, you know, it would make our job easier in terms of being able to evaluate charities. And also, I mean, it would just be good to have, you know, the information that charities are pressured to share, it would be nice if that were the right information. As opposed to the information they share now. And we've put this together in collaboration with New Philanthropy Capital, which is kind of like us in the UK, and with we've actually worked with the guy at Charity Navigator on that too. So that's the 10-question framework, and then the other one is more like donor-facing, where it's a by-cause. So we took like every charitable cause we could think of or find and wrote up just a bunch of critical questions for charities in that cause. And for some of those are based on research we've done, and they're good questions, and for other causes, we just kind of, like, pulled questions out of the air. But the point is, you know, that's another offering to someone like Charity Navigator that they could say, okay, what cause are you interested in? Click the cause. Okay, here are the questions you should ask a charity in that cause. And, again, I mean, we think they're better questions than people ask now. It's kind of a changing attitude thing, and it could get more information out there. It's not, like, a huge value, but it's not a huge cost to us. And it helps move some of these partnerships forward, maybe, hopefully.
Never a New Philanthropy Capital before. They're like you guys.
They were. I mean, they were the one, when we started. They were the closest to us. They're this UK organization. There's some differences now. They've sort of moved to different. From instead of doing evaluation, they're doing more consulting to nonprofits to be more effective.
I mean, there's just to be clear. I mean, that, you know. There's obvious differences with us and them. I mean, I don't, you know, I've always found the research reports to be too kind of, you know, to be not tough enough on the charities, but it's certainly, I mean, they're visiting charities, they're like, they're trying to go in depth, they're not the, you know, the formula-based guys, so that's the sense in which they're similar to us. And, you know, so we worked with them on this thing. Greg, the topic was our partnerships. How are those coming along? That was kind of... Oh, good. You're good. Other thoughts? Does anyone feel the need to wrap up the other stuff? I mean, I don't have much to say. It's just stuff we're thinking about. I mean, you know, I don't have, like, a strong position right now. Or what I do have, we've been over.
Budget update.
Okay, budget update. We do need a formal vote on this. I separated the 2009 budget because that's what you're going to be seeing in the audited financials. When we pass those around, which will be fairly soon, that's what's going on in our 990, so I just thought it'd be good to do the whole year at once. Oh, is this the old one that I have? Or did I ever even... I thought I changed this to the one I did.
Doesn't matter, it's fine.
Yeah. I really thought I did.
It's fine. You didn't? Okay.
Okay. So...
need to vote on is the forward-looking budget. We also can review the past budget if anyone wants to go back to that.
Yeah. I mean, do people read this attachment? Do people have questions? Do people want me to do an intro and walk people through it?
I read it.
I did not have questions.
I was a little concerned about how radically we underspent on D&O insurance.
How what?
Radically we underspent on D&O insurance.
Yeah, I don't know what happened there. Wait, how radically we under... Oh, we just didn't pay the bill yet, yeah. there was another one, there was one budget where we had budgeted, like, nothing for insurance, or for accounting or insurance or something. I didn't know why that was.
By 10 times as much, that person?
It was insurance for 2009 that we just must have never approved a big line item for insurance. It's not a big cost. Do you guys want to vote on this?
Yes.
I hope this isn't approving silence, not a somber silence. Okay.
Our previous conversation beat everyone to silence.
I mean, I approve this budget.
I'm in favor.
I'm in favor.
I'm in favor on the phone.
Tim Ogden's in favor.
You don't get to vote.
I'm not saying anything.
Anything else?
Did you guys happen to mention the Money for Good study at all?
Not during the meeting.
There's a blog post on it coming up.
Okay. I just for other board members, I think it would be worth taking a look at it in terms of informing your thinking about GiveWell and where it fits and how others are thinking about the market.
Yeah, that's true.
The study is a big Hewlett-funded survey of donors about where they give and why they give the way they do.
Was this linked to on your blog as well?
Not on the GiveWell blog. I mean, we're going to post something about it relatively soon. The big headline of the report is most donors don't do research before they give and think very critically about where they give.
Do not money for good.
Not, yeah, money for good.
Yeah. We can send it out to the board.
Yeah, that would be great.
Shocking. I know, it's a shocking result.
And for anybody who's also interested, they did three recent posts on the Tactical Philanthropy blog that sort of explains the research as well.
Okay.
Tim, do you want to send out the email to the board?
No.
He would love to.
The full report is downloadable from Hope Consulting, H-O-P-E, hopeconsulting.us. Yeah, it's like a 4 megabyte file if you want to download it. But the quick and easy version, like I said, is they wrote up about their findings on the Tactical Philanthropy blog, and that gives the level of detail I think most people would want, unless you really want to delve into it and want to go through the 4 megabyte, 100-slide research presentation.
Is this the U.S. market opportunity for impact investments and charitable gifts for individuals?
I think so.
Yes, that sounds like what it's titled.
Does anyone want me to send the link to this? I can send it right now.
Sure.
All right.
You're going to save me so much time. I'm happy.
Consider it my donation to GiveWell.
Ooh, ouch.
Okay. Anything else?
Linda, you don't have a No Hope neighbor, do you?
I'm sorry?
You don't know Hope neighbor, do you?
No. Is that a person?
It is a
person. Is it time to...
I think it's time to adjourn.
Is that a person who was at the Kennedy School?
She very well may have been, yeah.
Yeah, I think I do. Okay, yeah.
Tom, can you please adjourn this meeting before that gets resolved?
Yeah, I'd like to adjourn the lowest energy GiveWell board meeting in history.
Oh, I don't think so. No, that's true.
That's true.
Lowest energy for sure.
Yeah.